This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Nearly half of Puerto Rico's population is covered by Medicaid, but officials on the island say the money's running out and they could be facing a healthcare crisis. Secretary of State Luis Rivera Marin spoke to Intersection during a recent visit to Orlando, where he met with Puerto Rican business, faith and community leaders to discuss the healthcare situation on the island.
One of the big concerns for Puerto Rico, Secretary, is the Medicaid situation. Tell me, what's going on with Medicaid in Puerto Rico right now? Like, how many people in Puerto Rico on the island are dependent on Medicaid?
Right now, it's close to 1.6 million Puerto Rican U.S. citizens that reside in the island need and access Medicaid funds. We are talking about the most vulnerable population of the island. We're talking about children. We're talking about the elderly and those handicapped. When you compare the Medicaid participation subscription rate in the island to those of the stateside jurisdictions, we are the highest percentage of people that depend on Medicaid for their health. Certainly, when Obamacare was enacted, Puerto Rico was treated differently, and we were allocated. We didn't have an exchange. We were allocated a lump sum of $6.2 billion for a time period, for a period of 6 years. For that amount, we were able to finance the health program. Nevertheless, it was an unsustainable solution, which now we are facing the cliff, what we are calling the Medicaid cliff, whereby if we are not properly funded, we will be facing running out of funds before the end of the year. With the part that the state currently supports through state financing, we will be able to take care of half of the population, so more than 700,000 residents of the island will be left out in the cold. And we're talking about children receiving chemotherapy. We are talking about the elderly. And that's probably one of the reasons, and through this particular visit to Central Florida, we've been able, not anecdotically, but talking with church pastors, talking with actual families which made their decision to move from the island to Central Florida based exclusively on being able to access proper health care for the family. So if we're talking about dollars and cents, what we're proposing to legislators, to Florida's delegation in the U.S. Congress, is that if it's something about dollars and cents, like we hear on the news, then it's not a good proposition, because what in Puerto Rico, what we do, we take care of a single person. It takes almost five times more resources to do it in the mainland, specifically in Florida, 10 times in Texas. And that's where the Puerto Ricans are moving and relocating to get a better health. We're trying to move forward and follow up on what Governor Ricardo Rosselló recently did by writing a letter to Governor Rick Scott, precisely pointing out that this has been the largest wave of migration we've seen in Puerto Rico's history. We had one back in the 50s, but in just 5 years, 400,000 Puerto Ricans have moved just to Florida.
Are you saying, Secretary Rivera Marin, that if things don't change, if the U.S. government doesn't decide to put some money in place to help fund Medicaid in Puerto Rico, that wave of folks leaving the island and moving to the mainland is going to continue at maybe even a higher rate?
It would be the logical result of a free flow of migration, since, as you know, we can move freely. We don't have any immigration restrictions. So with the $100, you purchase a plane ticket and you come here to get better education, better health. So I think it's about justice. It's about equity. It's about human rights. So if economic, it's what's moving the decision-making in D.C., then the proposal that we put forth is it would not only cause disruption in the state of Florida and other states, it would also be a bad economic proposition. If it costs you five times more and we do it with less money, why don't you allocate the funds?
Do you mind if I just ask then, what are you asking for? Like, what is the solution? Because you mentioned a figure of $6.2 billion, I think, but that was for a certain number of years, and this is something different you're putting on the table?
Our objective is to get a urgent legislative vehicle which is sustainable and equitable. We put that to numbers, I will be able to share with you what would be equitable. If we were a state, we would be receiving in Medicaid funds 83% of our investment, because this is not a cost, this is an investment in health. We now receive 53% because we are capped. Return us to what the previous formula was, but you cannot leave Puerto Ricans out in the cold, because that would suppose children without proper health care. It would suppose crisis and all health institutions. It would be a massive outflow of Puerto Ricans, probably to this great state. So I predict with certainty that that would be the result of not addressing this issue as a human rights issue. We pay taxes. We are not even asking to be treated equally in an equitable way. If we will be treated like the states would be treated, we will be receiving $5 billion additional because of our income and poverty levels in the island. I would like to compare it to the poorest state in the nation. And when you look at the poorest state in the nation, which is Mississippi, they have 600,000, close to 600,000 beneficiaries, and we have 1.6 million. So we have a million more beneficiaries, and they get $3.8 billion in federal funds. We get 1.8.
So, Luis Rivera-Marin, who is your ally in Congress right now? I know there are a couple of, some Puerto Rican representation up on Capitol Hill, but who are you lobbying? Like, who's on your side as far as funding Medicaid to the amount that you think it should be funded?
The senator from Florida has been helping us. The Congressman Curbelo has been helping us. Congressman Diaz-Barral has been advocating for Puerto Rico. Everyone, we've been visiting intensively D.C., and people really can understand our issues, but then we don't have two senators, and we don't have proper representation, which makes it much more difficult. But certainly those states where Puerto Rican vote, where politics become local, certainly they feel the electoral pressure whereby they have elections coming up every 2 years. But certainly Florida has been supportive. This week we are meeting with local state legislatures. They've been supportive. It's in the best interest. Nevertheless, there's a short list in D.C., and being able to get in that short list has certainly been an issue for us and a challenge. And everybody's discussing what will happen with the American healthcare and Obamacare repeal or replacement, and it's hard for us to get in that conversation.
It's also hard, I think, right now, because the mood in Washington, D.C. seems to be one of cutting budgets wherever you look, and unless it's defense spending, there doesn't seem to be an appetite for spending more money on anything. So are you confident that things can turn around, that the Puerto Rico will get the funding it needs for its healthcare system?
I'm confident in the United States. Certainly, public policy in Washington is one that faces us with great risks, and we are measuring those risks. We're talking about health. And at the end of the game, I believe that reason will prevail, that congressmen and congresswomen will recognize that they will not allow the news to show what could be the eventual result of not addressing this issue properly, whereby the U.S. could be facing really a shameful situation with 3.4 million residents and the island left out in the cold. I don't see that as a possibility, but certainly the landscape that you present to me is one that I must agree with you is what is in discussion right now and what we are facing. But every time we put forth our case with the obvious results, which are not cost-effective, having it, because we can move around. That's the escape valve that we have in that boiling pot.
And just to kind of reiterate, you're saying that it makes much more sense for folks to get the health care they need on the island of Puerto Rico rather than saying, look, I'm going to move to Florida or I'm going to move to New York or wherever it is because I can't get the health care I need here on the island.
I think that's our strongest case, and nobody can stop us. There's no executive order from the president that can stop that from happening. So certainly that is our case, and I think it holds strongly, but we need to make the message, put out the message, because lawmakers are really unaware sometimes of these issues. They're aware about the local issues, and if they help us, they might get some local heat, and that we find those situations happen. But I would like to thank the whole delegation in Senate, Marcos Rubio, and in Congress that have certainly been an ally to Puerto Rico, to our Congresswoman Jennifer Gonzalez, and certainly when the Secretary Price was going through his hearings, confirmation hearings, the senator from the great state of Florida did address specific questions asking what will he do regarding the healthcare issues in the island.
Just finally, obviously, this will not be your last visit to Florida ahead of decision day as far as Medicaid goes. Are you looking for some hard work ahead to try and persuade folks in Congress that it's the right thing to do to put Medicaid funding in place to help out Puerto Rico?
I'm behind a governor that doesn't rest. I'm behind a governor and an administration and a legislature that has come out from the starting gate in January 2nd nonstop with legislation, and certainly the governor, through an executive order, established a task force with the private sector, which I'm heading, and certainly Florida is that stakeholder in the continental U.S. where I find more echo in our claims, and actually amplify them and find a voice in Congress.
That was Puerto Rico's Secretary of State, Luis Rivera Marin. Still to come, how close is Daytona Beach to building a homeless shelter? Faith leaders and city officials are hoping they'll soon have the county funding to build a new shelter. We talked to Father Phil Egito about the role of the faith community in helping the homeless. And we visit artist Andrew Rose's makeshift studio. It's suspended on a scaffold inside Florida Hospital, where he's creating a giant mural.
Currently, we're about 25 feet off the ground. The whole structure takes us up to 40 feet. It's three stories high.
That's later in the show. Don't miss an episode of Intersection. Download the podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The debate in Daytona Beach over how to help the homeless came to a head last year as dozens of homeless camped out in front of the county administration center downtown. Community leaders agree the city needs a new shelter, but they're still trying to figure out how to pay for it. Well, Father Phil Egito is the pastor at Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic Church in Daytona Beach. He's one of the faith leaders eager to see a new homeless shelter built in Daytona Beach. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. My pleasure. We're really excited.
Take us back to January 2016, and this is when the homeless situation in Daytona Beach was really visible. You had nearly 100 homeless folks camped out in downtown Daytona Beach. Did that seem like a moment of crisis for the city?
Oh, I think it clearly was a moment of crisis for the city, and it really caused, I think, everybody nationally and in the world took notice, because I think it made national news and world news, which is certainly not the impression we want to give of Daytona Beach, since it is a tourist attraction for the entire world knows right. Where Daytona Beach is. So we have a lot of events. We have a lot of races for NASCAR and other events that it really was, you know, a stain on the city to say that we're not taking care of our homeless. And so they camped out in front of a county building because mm-hmm. I think legally they could. We have no shelter. So from what I understand, with case law, there's a thing called Pottinger, which says that if you have no place to bring people, they have every right to be people everywhere.
Right.
And so basically you could not arrest them. And in front of a county building, I think it gave them special ability to be there. Mm-hmm. And so they camped out there. And it was kind of a movement of the homeless kind of put themselves together to do that on purpose. And it did create quite a stir. The city, Daytona has been really very wonderful in all of this. And they immediately looked for solutions. They made a contract with the Salvation Army, who had a gym right near Beach Street. And they basically contracted with them to put the homeless up for, I think it was first 30 days, then 60 days, and then it was 90 days. I think they went quite a while. And then the Salvation Army said, you know, we can't do this forever. This was mm-hmm. just a temporary fix. The city then, I think, really attempted not to throw people back on the street. And they did rent hotel rooms for people so that they wouldn't throw people back on the street. They really did have compassion. That didn't work well because the homeless then had no food service right. or anything else. I think Daytona really meant well, and I think it was a great idea and a great plan. But sometimes people who are not able to fend for themselves, it just getting a place to stay wasn't really sufficient. And so that kind of ran out, and basically the homeless have been back on the street since.
But so there is this plan for a shelter, right? And that plan has been floating around for some time.
Well, there's been several plans, and my organization has worked with other organizations to put together a plan. Not that I think that that's our job to do, but it was very hard for anyone to ask cities to support anything if there was nothing to support. So we did come up with a plan, and other organizations were involved with that at the time when we wrote it. We're not stuck to it. It's mm-hmm. not carved in stone. It was a plan so that we could move forward. Last year on, I think it was March 2nd, the county had said that they were open to looking at a plan, and they had asked the Commission on Homelessness to come up with a plan. And from what I gather, I don't think much happened with that.
Just remind us what the organization that you're part of is.
I'm part of an organization called FAITH. Mm-hmm. It stands for Fighting Against Injustice Towards Harmony, and it's an organization of 32 churches.
And it's not primarily for addressing homelessness issues?
No. It's a grassroots organization, so every fall we have what are called house meetings, mm-hmm. where people get together with people of other congregations or their own congregations, and certain problem areas surface. And actually, 5 years ago now, the area of homelessness came to the forefront. And what happens after an issue, a problem area comes to the forefront, we then do research. Mm-hmm. So first we see, then we judge and do research. And so what we found out was that our continuum of care, the one element that was lacking was emergency shelter. Mm-hmm. I think at the time the Salvation had 18 shelter beds, which from what I understand they don't anymore. And so there were like maybe in all of Volusia County like 25 emergency crisis shelter beds, mm-hmm. which really was not sufficient. We have continued to be concerned for the past 5 years, and mm-hmm. we have been continuing to try to put forward a plan. Constantly meeting with city officials and trying to meet with county officials. This was an election year, so that was really a good thing because mm-hmm. I believe that our new officials have been, especially on the county level, Billy Wheeler, who was a city commissioner, I think, for South Daytona, she was very supportive of a homeless assistance center from the start of this, and she has continued to be supportive. Heather Post came in, and she was once a police officer, and so she understands the need for a homeless shelter. I personally know police officers who, with their own money, would put people in a hotel room. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't think anybody knows that. So I will say that because I know that for a fact. And, you know, they call me and we kind of work something out and we make it happen because sometimes there's just – I think the last month there was a couple, like they were like 80 years old and they were homeless. And the police officer had said, Father, we got to come. So we did, and he did. So people are actually very, very caring. And as I said, so a lot of the new county people, and Ed Kelly was the mayor of Ormond Beach. And last year, he committed to our organization while the mayor of Ormond Beach to commit $100,000 to his Ormond Beach budget for homelessness.
And he is now the chair of the Volusia County.
He is the chair of Volusia County, and he has constantly said, I think, written in the paper, but also to us, that he believes this is a countywide problem. And he has spoken to me, and I do have to believe he's a man of his word. Mm-hmm. And as a man of his word, I believe he will come through and follow through, because he basically wasn't able to come to our Action Assembly, which was last Monday. How our organization, we're not a service provider, we are a justice organization. And so basically, as I said, it came forward that shelter was missing. And so we look at, when we do our research, who can solve this problem. And so therefore, holding people accountable. And we found that the cities and the county, we felt it was a countywide problem, and both need to work together to do that. And so that's kind of what we don't do agency kind of work. We don't give people food. We don't give people shelter. But what we do is we try to hold our officials accountable to solve the issues. Mm-hmm. So we had a meeting, and how we do that then is every spring we have a meeting of as many will come as will come to out of our organization. So this past year, we had 1,600 people gather at the Peabody Auditorium.
This was last week.
Last Monday. We had 1,600 people gather at the Peabody Auditorium. And basically who came was, now, Billy Wheeler, she was unable to come. It was her uncle's 90th birthday or something. And we gave her a pass, but she did answer our questions. And Joyce Cusack was there. She's a member at large. And Heather Post. And all three of them committed to giving the land, which is ideal. The city has land, but it's not as ideal as the county land. To do the city piece of land, infrastructure has to change, and a lot of work has to go into it. The county land is right near the jail. It's right near Stuart Marchman. It's got bus service. It's a perfect location, which I had talked about last time I was here. Mm-hmm. And so they all agreed to give, you know, up $2 million. They had agreed years ago to give $4 million for the construction. In our new plan, we got the construction down to $2 million. So we want the other $2 million over the 5-year time, giving $400,000, matching what the Daytona Beach has committed to, which is they have committed now to $400,000 a year for the next 5 years. So for them to actually, it's not really costing them anything other than what they agreed to. It's just that it's going to be $2 million for construction and $400,000 a year for 5 years for operations.
You're listening to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. With us in the studio, Father Phil Egido from Our Lady of Lourdes in Daytona Beach. We're talking about the homeless situation in Daytona Beach. So essentially, it sounds like you really need the county to come to the table here. It seems like that is now happening.
Yes. Well, Daytona Beach actually formed a 501c3. It's called First Step Shelter, and they have some wonderful people, and it's chaired by the mayor. And Mayor Derek Henry he's just been pushing ahead and leading this very strongly. He's been doing a great job. And so now that there is a 501c3, the county doesn't have to run it. The city doesn't have to run it, because government doesn't want to run this stuff. Mm-hmm. So there is a 501c3 who will run it. They have commitments from other organizations and agencies. I know Catholic Charities is willing to run it, provided that their budget is large enough to give people dignity. In other words, they don't want to run a warehouse. None of us want a warehouse.
Right.
We want a homeless assistance center where people will receive case management, be given dignity and respect, and to integrate them back into the community. And certainly the city, I think, would like more services to be out at the Homeless Assistance Center so that people can get away from downtown, where a lot of the homeless are preyed upon by a lot of crime.
Right.
I had a couple in my prayer garden at church spending the night, and I asked them point blank. I said, would you go to, you know, the Homeless Assistance Center? Because it's a ways. It's on the west side of town.
How far out of town? It's like how many miles?
It's west of 95. Mm-hmm. So there is bus service there, but it is west of 95, 1 or 2 miles west of 95. So it takes me, you know, 15 minutes by car to get there from the beachside. However, there is bus service there. And also it's centrally located. So people who are perhaps loitering or whatever can be brought there by the police. It's instead of jail, because it's not humane to put people in jail. And it is humane. And also, when people get out of jail, they have a place that they can go. Mm-hmm. So I asked the couple, and they said, you know, Father Phil, we don't want to stay downtown. There's a lot of crime. There's a lot of drugs. There's a lot of temptations. And we really would prefer to get out of downtown. But we're downtown only because that's where we can get – we can panhandle and we can get some services. But if there was a place where we could get food and we wouldn't have to panhandle and we wouldn't be preyed upon and we wouldn't be tempted to do the drugs and the alcohol and everything else, we would welcome that. And so they would be – so everyone I talk to who are homeless, we basically have what we call a community breakfast once a month. And I sit and have a meal, have breakfast with them. Many people are suffering from homelessness. And all of them say they certainly would welcome a place where they can – given a case manager, central location where they can move on in their life.
And this new shelter which you're pushing for, which it seems like the city and the county is kind of on the road to providing at some point in the future, that will be out of the downtown area of Daytona Beach.
Yes, it'll be out of the downtown. Now, some people aren't happy about that. Some of the agency providers feel that it needs to be walking distance from downtown.
Right.
But it's kind of a, you know, the business owners obviously downtown certainly find, well, I myself included, I have a church, it's not downtown, but I don't want my people really panhandled when they come to church.
Sure.
I'd rather be able to give money to a homeless shelter and say, hey, here's a bus ticket, you can get food, you can get a case manager, you can get what you need. And, you know, I when I go to a restaurant on Beach Street, I don't enjoy being panhandled. I mean, I love my brother and sister and I want to give them help, but I know it's just I know giving them $5 isn't really helping them. I know that if we can get them to the homeless assistance center, that that would be a true helpful thing. So I would rather give money to the homeless assistance center than $5 to somebody who's on Beach Street.
Father Filogeto, how would this new shelter fit into the bigger picture of homeless assistance? Because there is a push to permanent housings for people who are homeless, right?
Absolutely. And I believe, well, as I said, we when we did our research, the shelter was the missing component. But, you know, there's a model called Housing First, which basically says you take people off the street and put them into an apartment and give them case management when they have stabilized and when they're ready for that. And because they're in an apartment, they will seek that themselves. And it's, from what I understand, it's a very effective. And a person brought to our shelter or comes to our shelter, I think, would be evaluated to see if they would qualify for how most Housing First programs, from what I understand, you have to be homeless for at least a year. So I think it's like 20% of those who are homeless for a year.
And is there a Housing First model in the Daytona Beach area now?
I believe the Coalition for the Homeless and our Commission on Homelessness is trying that, and it does work very well for veterans. Certainly, people at the Homeless Assistance Center, First Steps Shelter, we can call it. I think that'll be the name. I don't know. It doesn't matter what we call it. Will be evaluated. And if there is a housing – another problem is we don't have a lot of apartments available or housing, affordable housing in our community. And I think – I'm hoping that next year that's something we tackle again is affordable housing, because I know our state has an affordable housing trust fund, but I also know they dip into that and do many other things with that trust fund. In fact, I just wrote my legislators about that, not to be sweeping out the affordable housing because we need a lot more. But I think if somebody's waiting for an apartment, they can stay at the shelter. And if they qualify for Housing First, certainly case managers will know that and certainly will get them into permanent housing. As our goal is, all of us, our goal is permanent housing. So the shelter does not contradict Housing First, but I think it certainly complements it. But we certainly need a place to help people.
So I understand you've still got a couple of council members from the Volusia County Council who you want to get on side with us. What are you going to be doing this Thursday to try and persuade those council members?
Well, you know, this Thursday we're planning to go. We had, I think it was four who did not attend our action assembly, which I just think that's real important for them to respond, at least by, you know, answer our – we only have like four questions, and it's basically, are you willing to commit to helping the homeless? And broken down into four questions. But I get very disappointed that they don't attend. Sometimes I say, well, you know, we don't – you know, you're very rough with us. Well, we ask them yes or no questions, and we don't want to hear – we give them all 2 minutes to extrapolate on their answers and to say whatever they like to say, but we want to know the bottom line. You know, when we go before the county, we get 2 or 3 minutes to say our piece, and half of them aren't even there yet during public comment in the morning, but at least we would like them to come, and it's very disappointing. So because we had four did not come on Monday night, we said, well, you know what? We need to go to them and let them know that we support their vote on a homeless assistance center. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they don't have to decide the plan. First step shelter, you know, I mean, I don't know the plan. I don't have the details. It's really not. They said they don't want to do that, which is fine if they want to do it. I'm more than happy. Hey, you do the plan. You come mm-hmm. ask Father Phil for money. You ask the businesses for money. You do it all. I don't need to be doing this. You're elected to do this. But a lot of times they'll come up, well, we don't know the details of the plan. And well, they don't need to. Basically, what they're doing is saying, we're going to give First Steps, a 501c3, which has a mandate from the city to come up with a plan, approve the plan, hire the agency, however they want to run it, whatever details, how much they want to spend on toilet paper. I don't think the county wants to know all those details. And yet sometimes as a way of delaying or of deflecting, they come up with things like, well, I need to know more about the plan and whatever. So we're going to go there. Hopefully we'll have many people there just outside. It's not a protest. It's not a march. It's just saying to them, you did not come to us. We're coming to you.
So are you confident, Phil Egito, that this shelter will get built and fairly soon?
I am confident. As I said, we got three people committed, and I believe Ed Kelly has always been supportive, and I believe he will commit. Word on the street is he will commit. And I have been disappointed before. I have been let down before. Sometimes they come up with red herring excuses
right.
as to how to deflect this, how not to make it happen. But I do believe there is political will. I also believe there is the will of the powers that be. And by that I mean is, you know, in our community, there are some big players. I mean, we have 35 churches, but we also have some big players. And I think the big players are kind of supportive and realize that this will save the county money. It'll help our brothers and sisters, and it's the right thing to do.
Well, Father Phil Egito is the pastor at Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic Church in Daytona Beach. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, artist Andrew Rose is painting something bigger than he's ever done before.
Almost twice the size of my first apartment out of college in San Francisco, which was a room and a small kitchen and a small bathroom.
We take a visit to a mural in progress. That's when Intersection continues. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Andrew Rose is working on a giant mural. Rose is a painter from Hawaii, and he started working on this artwork on a wall inside Florida Hospital for Women back in December. To create the 18-foot-high mural, Rose had to have a multi-level scaffolding built. There are buckets and pulleys to haul up supplies, a comfy chair on one level so he can sit back and contemplate the painting as it takes shape, and there's a series of ladders connecting the different levels.
We've taped everything to be visually recognizable. When I first got on the scaffolding, I couldn't see the edges. So as you can see at the front, we've got red and yellow stripes. So in my peripheral vision, I would know where I was because there's anywhere between 10 to 14 inches away from the wall, which is just big enough to drop brushes and your glasses or a shoe. And so I don't want to step off and lose my balance.
Have you lost a shoe?
I have lost paintbrushes, I've lost palette knives, I have certainly almost lost a shoe, gloves have gone over, but no humans. It's not big enough for us to get down. We've had to comply with all kind of OSHA rules and all those important things, and these guys, the B&G guys and their subs, have done a great job in making sure it's super safe. But you can also see we bought trampoline padding, these blue foam things, because you can't put a pool noodle on these crossbars. The hole is too small. So we got that because you can bang your head because it's so low, some of this support. So everything has been marked out and made safe, so I'm not banging my head or scraping my hands or twisting anything. So you step on this red step, you climb all the way down, you meet the next red step, and you step off right at the red tape. As you can see, I'm straddling the well here. I'm probably, 15 feet above the catwalk. I couldn't do this the first week, but now I hang out up here and talk with friends. It's like a jungle gym. It's totally fun.
After we clamber onto the platform, Rose explains the work that's gone into creating this giant painting.
The painting is actually scaffolded for three stories. Currently, we're about 25 feet off the ground. The whole structure takes us up to 40 feet. It's three stories high. It was put together by a great team overnight from 7 to 7. And when I came on it the first morning, the sway of it was so disorienting that I couldn't concentrate or see that they've stabilized it. So the comfort that we have up here was really facilitated by the hospital. And each floor is about 7 feet.
You had to have them sort of brace the scaffolding against the walls here to stop it from wobbling around.
For the painting, yes. The team that puts it together is working on some of the big theme parks, and they build 50 and 100-story scaffolds for buildings and rides. And so they thought it was hilarious that I had to have it perfectly stable.
How big is this painting? Like, just describe the scale and scope of it.
The painting is 40 times the size of the original, and it's 18 feet high by almost 13 feet wide for a total of over 200 square feet.
Is this the biggest thing you've ever done?
This is three stages or three sizes of a normal mural I might do. So imagine that stacked vertically. So yes, it's the biggest project, biggest single painting I've done so far. The painting being over 200 square feet, 216 square feet, is almost twice the size of my first apartment out of college in San Francisco, which was a room and a small kitchen and a small bathroom. So to go from there to here is an amazing journey.
And what I'm looking at, it looks to me like there's some kind of impressionism going on here, right? It's pointillism.
Pointillism, you're absolutely correct. So on this set of walls that we have up here to inspire me and to remind me of where it came from, you'll see a couple of printouts of Paul Signac, who was a post-impressionist and worked in separating color, as the pointillist did, so that the relationship of two brushstrokes would, between those two colors, create a third color. And that resonance, that harmony, is what they were trying to achieve. And the breakdown of those colors was exceptionally modern for the time. So that's one part of this painting. The other part is that printout of Rembrandt's painting Danae, just below those Signac paintings. And that original story was about divine light from the heavens. And the original painting was that spray of golden light that the team here saw and felt that really represented what they wanted to have guests and staff come see as they enter and leave the building. And so if you compress those two ideas together, you smash those two ideas together, you get this divine light that has been created through over 10,000 individual brushstrokes that together create more color than their original colors themselves.
And the rest of Florida Hospital, some of those other big artworks, I mean, there's a really sort of overt spiritual element, mm-hmm. and you're channeling some of that with, you know, divine light. And I'm thinking, too, that, you know, a lot of the Renaissance paintings you would see, they would have this spiritual element to them. Is that something that's common in your work anyway? Do you sort of work in that genre?
My paintings, of which this is part in terms of a large series of works that deal with the natural elements approaching something greater than ourselves. There were several bodies of work in the last decade that dealt with what is liminal, what's on the edge of our consciousness, what do we experience on the verge of something. And each one of these brushstrokes in the series that this was, called the Rain Paintings, that started when we had a 40-day deluge in Hawaii many years ago, each one of these brushstrokes is talking about joining together and becoming something greater than itself. This particular painting that inspired it is an allegory by Rembrandt of some of the central origin stories of Christianity, particularly the Immaculate Conception. So it's, we've been using the word somewhat loosely, but it's miraculous that the original painting is so close to what this building is about. And For me, in coming to this space and learning from Chaplain Carl and the team here that what is exactly the theology and the components of what it means to be a Seventh-day Adventist is now put into the painting. And so it's much greater than some of the questions of spirit and space and our place in the universe that have been imbued in my paintings. So that's the long answer. The short answer is, yes, of course, every artist is looking towards something greater than oneself, universal, communicating our place in the world. So this light commission has been really in conjunction with the Adventists and their mission. And funnily enough, people come by all the time and say, this looks like Michelangelo and Monet. And I think that's really great that already before it's done, people are picking up on those touchstones and those intentions of those two great artists. So it's a real compliment.
Andrew Rose is also setting the bar pretty high too, right? Do you feel there's some pressure on you to live up to those compliments?
It's very flattering, and yes, indeed.
Can we just take a closer look here and just walk over to the work surface? And how do you go from the painting you're basing this on to the full-size piece? Like, is it a stroke-for-stroke representation, or is the original painting's like an idea and you sort of use that as the genesis of what we see here? How does that work?
You're picking up on a lot of how we built this painting from the bottom layer through what will end up being the varnish. I often talk to students of mine at the museum back in Honolulu that painting is like a cake. It has multiple layers, and you need to create the bottom layers to get to the top layers. What you see right in front of you are some of the original brushstrokes and the underpainting that started about 40 layers ago. So behind this is sealer and primer and gesso and
painting. What's gesso?
Gesso is traditionally chalk and rabbit skin glue. Nowadays, when you mention the Renaissance, that's where it started. Nowadays, what we use is a polymer-based whiting that, in this case, is made by Golden, and all the colors here are made by Golden, and they're at the forefront of paint science.
So you're not using, like, house paint or something. What's the paint that goes on top of it?
This is a system of paint that is all acrylic. It's designed to be light fast, so the colors won't fade. And once you put the varnish on it, which has a UV protection just like your sunglasses, it shouldn't look any different 100 years from now than what you're seeing today. With my degrees from Pratt in art history and painting, I got a very good grounding in the science of art and what it takes to make something permanent. And so for me, as a teacher of painting, as an artist, and as a student of it, a continuous student of it, it's essential to think about the future and how a painting can be made to last. So what you see when you ask, how did we get it bigger? There's a grid over here that we ended up blowing up square for square, mapping it out, taping it to the wall, which combines three of the ways that people will scale up a mural. It's gridded out, it's projected on the wall, and then it's done freehand. So all of this underpainting that you see here of these large shapes were all made freehand based on the map of the original painting.
And you've got little post-it notes stuck all over, like less prominent pinks. This one here is all scratched out, but it says softer and maybe more distinct petals underneath.
As an artist, one crosses over to the non-verbal side of the brain. And so when you're working, you are in a sort of timeless space and a wordless space. And once you step out of that and you enter back in that verbal world, you start engaging with thoughts that may be fleeting. And so I use Post-its all the time because I know I'm going to forget. And so when I think, when I step away from the painting, I have these ideas that I can put into words, and I remember them once I come back to it because of the notes. So it's a good help.
So do you have to step, like physically sort of step away and look at it from a distance and then sort of write the note and stick it on? Because when you're up close to it, it must be difficult to see the big picture, so to speak.
You're absolutely right. I get sometimes 10,000 steps a day. I get my health in just walking back and forth on the scaffolding up to the mezzanine. There's a story that Leonardo told the abbots of the convent in Milan, where he did the Last Supper. He told the abbots that when he was sitting there and they wondered why he wasn't painting, he said 75% of painting is looking. And so I spend a lot of my day in these pieces of furniture that you see around, just looking, just thinking, looking away, looking at the painting, because you're right. Being right up close to it is an exercise in trust. You have to trust the brushstroke and the color, that it's going to do what you want it to do. And so I've matched each one of these colors to the original painting, which we brought, which I had sent over. So it's a color for color expansion. And so that takes a lot of looking, and it takes a lot of moving back and forth every day.
And then just looking at some of the stuff you've got tacked to the walls here, I mean, you've got sort of a combination of technical things like color charts and the gridded out map of your painting here, but you've also got a photograph of Cher. You've got, I think, is that Susan Sarandon there underneath?
It's actually Majel Barrett. She plays Loaxana Troi in Star Trek. She's also the voice of the computer. When I had my assistant here for the beginning part of the project, every couple of days we'd find another inspiring woman to put up on the wall because it's the Women's Center, and people pass by every day and get really excited. So on Martin Luther King Day, we put up Rosa Parks. Some other days we just were talking about what inspired us. When Carrie Fisher died, we put up pictures of Princess Leia and Tina Fey as Princess Leia. So every day is a new, important, accomplished person who inspires us in the community. But yes, there's color charts for the time lapse that we're doing, the reproduction of the images. Each floor has been photographed every 30 seconds for the last several months. So there will be a compilation of that. I've been wearing a GoPro, you know, iPhone videos. Everything has been documented so that we can share it with the community afterwards. And that some of those things are going to help us make it look great.
When's the end date?
A painting is somewhat like a child. It tells you what it needs. It sometimes cries out. It sometimes walks away and says, "I hate you." And it's very much a conversation. So at the beginning, we had a very distinct vision and direction, and that has grown over the time that I've been here. So originally the plan was to do this in 6 to 8 weeks, and now we're looking at another couple weeks, and all told it's going to be several months of work, which is to Florida Hospital a major inconvenience, but an investment in the future, because like we said, it's going to be here hopefully for 100 years or more, and it's worth every day that we're putting into it.
What's it been like working on this for the last few weeks physically? Is it challenging?
I've lost nearly 15 pounds. I have great shoulder muscles and arm muscles. I have developed tendonitis in my painting elbow. My knees give out. It's taxing. I've gone through 3 pairs of shoes. And currently, I'm doing the night shift because it's quieter and I can work better for longer. So that's the sort of immediate physical activity. The outcome of that is it feels like I'm in my own personal jungle gym and treehouse all at the same time. It's a great place to be.
That's painter Andrew Rose. You can see photographs of the work in progress at our website, wmfe.org. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from Florida Hospital. Intersection's producer is Brandon Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Our intern is Talia Blake. If you missed an episode, you can download the podcast. You can find that on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast fix. And you can also listen back on our website. Thanks to everyone who helped us out during our silent drive. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.